papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smugger.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary on what's going on in the news media these days, with some veteran journalists from this region looking over our shoulders and looking forward to see what's happening. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American, and I am here in the studio with three colleagues. Ira Fussfeld, formerly the publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. And Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. So what are y'all thinking about? What's in your mind, Judy?
You know, it wasn't our imagination. There are more lawsuits being filed against people for libel. There's a new database out there, it's a few months old, that tracks slap lawsuits. So let's talk about that a bit.
Cool. We'll talk about slapping and explain to folks what that is. We will. Barbara Lombardo, what's up?
I'm in the mood for a different kind of slapping. I had it with the press rolling over when the president is clearly lying.
All right.
I think that this whole issue of the press being bullied is certainly a story in and of itself. But the question is, what should we do about it? And we can talk about that.
Terrific. All right. We have a great set of conversations coming up. And there's more. We promise, folks. That's not it. But let's talk about this SLAP first. Just to define what we're talking about, SLAP is an acronym. It stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. That is lawsuits filed in the case of our interest here against newspapers by public officials, trying to basically get them to back off. And what Judy is saying is that there's a new database that's been compiled that documented 500 SLAP cases last year. And interestingly, that's only looking at 38 states, because there are only 38 states that have laws that try to stop this kind of maneuvering in the court system. So if there are 500 slap cases, probably say six dozen of them or so roughly by about the news media, this suggests that there is a lot of effort in court to try to get journalists to back off. Right.
Right. And this only applies to lawsuits that have actually been filed. It doesn't apply to the threats of lawsuits, which are probably 10 times as more. And what this does is put a damper on the press's ability to act freely, to do what they need to do to hold government accountable. I mean, I invite everyone to go to this database and just wander through some of the lawsuits. The database does a good job of summarizing what's out there, where things stand, and just the potential. Often, a lot of these lawsuits are just frivolous, but the amount of time and money a media company needs to spend just defending itself, even against frivolous lawsuits, is immense. And what it does is it takes away from your ability to do what you need to do, which is report the news.
So why do you think that the number has increased? Besides the fact that we never really had a database, so maybe it hasn't increased. But if, in fact, it has, what's been the tipping point? Did the people who choose to sue the media finally recognize that even if you're unsuccessful, you succeed in tilting the media off the rails and you're costing the media money to defend itself even in frivolous lawsuits? Why is this happening now?
Do you think it has anything to do with the impact of the White House doing this kind of thing? I mean, the president himself has a $15 billion lawsuit pending against the New York Times that every legal expert I've seen says is frivolous.
I suspect this predates Trump. It just seems to me when I was still active, the threats of lawsuit were always out there, and this was before Trump actually was suing.
It can be debilitating, though, because even if you have, say, libel insurance, there is a deductible, usually about, what, $50,000 these days? $50,000. And so that's a lot of money, you know, for a small news organization.
Yeah, especially. And it doesn't take into account the amount of time that you have to spend focusing on defending yourself as opposed to doing journalism, for example.
Yeah, and the money that it costs to get something like this dismissed. I think it's great that the First Amendment Watch is doing this because measuring the actual numbers gives you a better handle. As you're saying, like, what has it changed over the past? And I think they've already established that it has changed and that the number is actually growing from into 2025. And yet almost two-thirds of the cases have been from 2024 have been dismissed. Like normally, they said just under half of the cases end up getting dismissed. But of these particular cases, two-thirds. So that it points out how frivolous these are and how expensive it is to the news outlets. So it could have a chilling effect.
I remember having to defend against a lawsuit that was brought by a lawyer who was upset that he thought we had written a story based upon a press release, which he had issued, that he put at the top a release date after our story. Actually, our reporter had gotten the information independently, but he sued us alleging breach of deadline, a breach of embargo.
Ooh, off with your head. Something that doesn't really exist.
It doesn't exist. But still, we had depositions. We had to have a lawyer come up from our corporate headquarters in New York. There was a considerable expense involved in this. Now, if it actually is a frivolous case in the state of New York, we have some protection. We can actually get lawyers' fees, get our legal costs reimbursed. You never get your time back, but this will discourage it somewhat. But in Europe, as the folks who put this database together at First Amendment Watch note, Europe is really far ahead of us because they actually do some training for judges and lawyers to help them identify what is a slap and to try to stop this kind of abuse of the legal system.
You know, I concede that people have a right to sue a media company if they feel they have been libeled. But what we're talking about here are frivolous lawsuits, and they come at a time when a lot of media companies are, especially local newspapers and local radio and TV outlets, that their finances are really strapped, and the idea of a $50,000 deductible is one that will diminish the amount of risk-taking the journalists are doing when it comes to holding local government accountable.
And this goes far beyond traditional media outlets that are getting sued with these frivolous cases. They have reported that 69 of the cases were particularly involving the media, but other ones are similarly concerning: publishers, documentary filmmakers, even social media influencers have all been sued. And I didn't look down to see what the breakdown of, but all of those are types of people who are ostensibly trying to tell the truth.
Nor is this just about politicians, by the way. Think about it. If you're a developer on a multi-million dollar project that is quite controversial and the media coverage is unfavorable to you, perhaps, based upon, say, your environmental track record or your financing, it could be simply a cost of doing business in your mind to have this kind of litigation filed against a news organization as you go through the years-long process that it frequently takes to get your development approved by the local agencies. So, and that's probably where most of it comes. I think that what has been increasing in recent years is the willingness of politicians to do this. So it would be ideal, of course, to have federal legislation, federal anti-slap legislation. I believe that's quite unlikely with Donald Trump in the White House and a supine Congress.
And imagine that still becomes something that you have to defend against, and it takes it a step back as the loss. And I also find the acronym extremely strained, although it's memorable to be able to say SLAP with two P's. It's a weird acronym, although calling it the Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation does try to hit home the point that it's not just a punishment for the media, it's a punishment of the public.
I can recall my first budget was as the editor of the newspaper, and I walked into the budget room and the CEO said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm doing pretty good, and I'm keeping us out of court." And he said, "Well, is that a good thing? Maybe you're not being aggressive enough in your reporting."
Good for him. Yeah. How about that? That was your previous ownership, ownership that paper at the end. Good. That's the kind of boss you want. By the way, it is the Slap Back Initiative, Slap with two P's of the First Amendment Watch, if you want to look that up. It's the media project. You can share your thoughts with us, media@wamc.org. That was Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. All right. You all wanted to talk about powerful people bullying the press. Who in the world might we be talking about here?
Well, you guys spent a lot of time on this several weeks ago, and I felt the need to revisit it because the problem, as described by what's going on in the White House, certainly has not diminished. It hasn't gone away. They weren't listening to us. I say that sarcastically. But the question in my mind now is, should we, the media writ large, be responding, publicly responding to these bullying tactics of the president? Or should we just say, look, newspaper people are out there, we get criticized all the time, and if we do something to publicly complain about it, we're only drawing more attention to ourselves. And that's not something that we would want to do.
Do you feel that way? Is that
I initially thought we should start screaming about this, but I'm becoming a little bit more, let's just do our jobs and let him say whatever he wants to say. We're going to be here long after he's gone.
Wow.
You don't agree with that, I take it, Barbara.
I don't agree with that. And the one part I do agree with what you said was that you don't want to be shouting about it. You don't want to make yourself the focus. You don't want to be a jerk about it, but you need to be calm and measured and strongly correcting the record when you have a president who 2 days ago is saying again that the media is the enemy of the American people and we need to do something about it. That is worrisome for safety of journalists and for the freedom of the press and for the public's right to know. And when you have a president who is asked a question saying, you said, the reporter started the question with, you said that it would be okay to release the video of the strike on the boats. And he cuts her off and says, that's fake news. I never said that. And of course, he did say it. It's on tape. You can read about it. And instead, the reporters continue with their other questions. Nobody says, you did say that. I'm torn myself of how much of a fuss do you make about it. But when you do nothing but move on and be polite, then you are normalizing, you're normalizing lies to the public.
Well, I would separate, though, two parts. One is what you just described. If he did, in fact, say it once before, the reporter should follow it up by saying, yes, you did. I have it on video. The question is whether the individual, the personal complaints, you're the stupidest person out there, you know, you're fake news. Is that something that we should respond to?
This is all part of a compliant press corps that needs to be reprimanded from our side, I think. This is wrong. I think we need to call attention to it. I think the president, it has increased his anti-media rhetoric, and increasingly he focuses on female reporters. The New York Times did an investigative piece about how the president is aging and how it's showing up in his work. And his response was to criticize, it was a male and a female reporter. His response was to say Katie Rogers, the woman reporter, who was assigned to write only bad things about me, is a third-rate reporter who is ugly both inside and out. He ranted about her. He did not touch the second reporter on the story. I mean, he's called reporters stupid, lazy, piggy. And the rest of the press corps, instead of saying, hey, that's our colleague, that's offensive, you should not be saying that. Or in Barbara's example, hey, hold up the phone with the audio of him saying exactly that, the video should be released. The people around him on the whole press corps, they need to stand up.
Every member of the press corps could have held that video up and started to play it. Any member, because he said it to the public. He said it for any of them. And as far as the name calling, where's the newsroom and the owners of that reporter? How did they respond? If they responded, I missed it.
You mean in terms of an editorial or a statement from
the publisher?
A public statement
that all the media could then cover. And something like we would do in the old days, sending a letter to the president, but also making it public.
The problem is, I think, with all of these responses, is that it gets lost in the important news of the day. I think the New York Times does respond when its reporters are attacked, and I think they put out a statement, but you don't get a lot of attention to it. And importantly, you don't get coverage of it on Fox News. Fox News, which is the source of information for the majority of Republicans in this country, continues to stand with the president to be basically Pravda to the Soviets. And I think that the people who continue to support the president, A, don't know about it, B, kind of like that approach, because this bold, careless nastiness is considered coin of the realm in the ultra-right now that runs the Republican Party. I'm sorry, but it is not the same across the board in American politics. This is regularized and endorsed and supported by half of the American political establishment. I like the idea of pushing back. I really do. But I just don't know that it's going to get us much leverage.
But it can't hurt.
Yeah, let's give a try. I mean, I'll concede that not a lot of people sit there and watch one of those rambling Donald Trump press availabilities. But for those who do, what they're seeing is him beat up on people and them just taking it. There may be a diplomatic way of reacting rather than saying, well, you know, you're ugly and fat too. But I think they're doing it because they want to retain access. I mean, every reporter, access is really important. They don't want to alienate it, or they don't want to be the next person for the insults to come their way. Most reporters have pretty thick skin, and we're seeing that. But as someone who once was in the industry and know that reporters are people too, what you're doing when you so vociferously attack us, you're undermining them and you're undermining what the press is doing overall.
So you're really trying to silence the public is the point here. You're there. What he's really trying to do is to manipulate public opinion. And you're right. We shouldn't just sit back and let it happen. I just think we need to be realistic about what it's going to do. Also, the White House press secretary is rather frequently called on the carpet. And she, of course, asserts that the president is just being frank and honest and that the American people love this. And I'm sorry. She stands there with a little cross around her neck and lies constantly. It just really ticks me off. But that's a press secretary and that's who she is.
Can I also say that he's president of the United States and he's supposed to be setting an example for young people, like children? Like, how is this a good example for children who are in elementary school, for example, or even secondary school? It leads to a coarsening of our whole society. There's no positives to this.
The problem is that a lot of people are turned off by the conflict altogether. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have so many news avoiders, which I think is a topic that would be really good for us to talk about. It is a fact that we have a huge growth. 40% of people say they often or sometimes avoid the news, that they consciously go out of their way to try to not pay attention to news, to avoid it. And I wonder if we have any great ideas about what to do about that. I mean, interestingly, by the way, the higher proportion of news avoiders are among younger people. It is our typical older folks who have grown up with newspapers around them who still want to get news. Younger people especially don't want to have anything to do with it.
Is the definition of news in this case what the four of us would define as news based on our own experience for decades? Or is it expanded to recognize that news sources are the non-traditional nature?
It includes various sources, but it is meant to be real news because this is research that we're reporting on from a University of Minnesota professor who's written a book called Avoiding the News, Reluctant Audiences for Journalism. So he's talking about the fact that people are, in fact, turning to other sources. 43% under the age of 30 regularly get news from TikTok, for example.
Yeah.
But that qualifies if it's actual journalism on TikTok, right?
Well, that's the question, whether TikTok, Instagram, any of the various sites, are they journalism in the way that we would define it? I would say the answer is no, but to narrow it down, people who are saying they're avoiding the news are not avoiding the news. They're still getting news from other sources. It just doesn't look like news.
You know what's really annoying about these people is they're so proud of the fact that they're, oh, I don't pay attention to the news. It's like, rather than the shame that they should be carrying, they are proud. Oh, no, I don't listen to the news. As citizens, they have an obligation to it. Oh, no. Barb, what do you think?
Well, I know people who I like and respect and are bright and were avid news followers, that they're not taking that approach. But they are just saying, for their own mental health, they can't keep following the news. They're making themselves crazy.
I think that's not a bad idea to take a break. Maybe give yourself a week of vacation or take a day, a week or two even. But I don't think citizens ought to give themselves the green light to just turn away.
I agree. Or don't listen all day because it's the same thing over and over.
Right.
And it's not entirely a new phenomenon. I can recall at a local newspaper, as what I published, that there is an old saw that young people didn't start paying attention to the news, not sports, where high school kids were reading the paper to see their name, but that young marrieds, for example, were not necessarily buying the local newspaper until they started having to pay school taxes or realized that their lives have changed. But when they were younger, it wasn't on their mind.
But what's the solution now when you don't have local media in place to actually report about those school taxes? The decline of the local media is such that folks are not even going to get the news they need to be good consumers.
Huge, but there are other places to have it if you can find it.
One of the encouraging elements of what's going on in the news ecosystem, I think, is the widening number of small hyperlocal news networks that are coming along. One of the fastest growing categories of local news organizations, national networks. There are 853 local news sites across 52 networks that do original reporting, according to a new report that's come out from Medill, Northwestern University. So this is good news. Now, these could be little tiny organizations with one or two reporters in a community, but that's good. That can be enough to at least give people a bit of information, right? At least there's an effort to track what's going on.
Can it be sustained?
Well, can you sustain it if there's if you don't have brick and mortar stores to buy the advertising,
right?
You can't sustain it just with revenues from your sales of circulation, basically.
But if it's a network, is it possible for the network as a total to, you're sort of subsidizing the ones that are doing weaker?
And like the way that the arts are subsidized by donations, you're really turning to charity, to philanthropy, to foundations, to community support. I think that is increasingly the way that news is going to be subsidized. Is how this newsroom continues to operate where we're sitting right now here at in public radio.
But what all of us in this room know is that, you know, producing news every day is hard work. It's work. It takes time. It takes energy. The idea of starting a newspaper is glamorous, is attractive, but once you get into it, it's almost like writing a column. Oh, everybody wants to write a column, and then they have to start writing it every week, twice a week. And I think that is the issue, is the persistence. Some of the models that we're talking about or we're looking at now is a franchise model where you pay $5,000 up front and they give you some of the support systems, some of the training, and you know there's a revenue share with it as well. It's something that is worth pursuing, but you have to do, you know, again, you have to raise your own money. You have to sell the ads. You have to find a way to financially support the effort, or you have to do it as on a volunteer basis.
And there's even more that you need than money, because you need reporters. And one of the things that's being touted in these networks is having reporters who are part of their community. They're ingrained in the community. They live there. They get to know it. They know the people. And so that's how you get good reporters. And then how difficult it is to find reporters who are willing to go into Nowheresville, USA. Are they really going to settle there long enough to learn anything that will help that outlet long term?
Mm-hmm. Good question. All right. Before we leave today, we have to talk about this very important topic, and that is Times New Roman. Ladies and gentlemen, you may have heard about this. The State Department has reversed a decision by the Biden White House to change all the State Department's printed work from Calibri type, which is a sans serif, you know, not doesn't have the little doomahingies on the end of it, back to Times New Roman. All right, editors, you know, we old print folks love typefaces. What do you think about this?
I don't think fonts get talked about enough. You know,
there's a way to sell newspapers.
And you know what? If you really want an interesting social media feed, just add some of these people, some of these graphic designers into your system, and you get really interesting discussions. I mean, so the idea is the Calibri is an easier to read font, and I think
supposedly,
and it was changed to Calibri under the Biden administration, and Secretary of State Rubio decided that it was too woke, and he uses this term. He uses this rationale for changing the font. It seems like there are better things.
Something I learned about the fonts as a professor at UAlbany is that there is a difference in the accessibility for people who have visual problems, visual challenges, and we have to take a course on how to make our programs accessible. And when I put something online for my students, it will give me a measurement of whether that is in an accessible font and in an accessible design. So there's a serious reason to want to do that. Other studies have shown that if seeing is not a challenge, if reading is not a challenge, that the fonts with the serifs are easier to read. Times New Roman, the Garamond, and usually we would leave those sans serif ones for the subheads and the captions.
It's amazing we're talking about this. To quote a former colleague of ours on this program, I think we're doomed.
You know, I one of the greatest messages on social media regarding this story was, there's a new serif in town.
Ooh. There you go. I'd hire that
all
person.
All right. That's all we have time for, folks. With that pun, we have to leave you. Except that I'm a great fan of Times New Roman. 14 points specifically. All right. That is the media project for this week. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We're grateful to the producer of this program, David Gustina, and especially to you folks for joining us. Hope you come back again next week for the media project.
She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.